Vivek Ranadiv had never coached a basketball game before. The 12-year-old girls on his daughter's team didn't have the size or the skills to compete, so they adopted an unconventional strategy, playing a full-court press every minute of every game. He took the team to the national championships. A nice story with a broader point. Whether in basketball or in war, underdogs, Davids, if you will, are almost certain to lose if they play by Goliath's rules. Unconventional might not work, but at least you've got a chance. Given that, why do so many Davids go ahead and play by Goliath's rules anyway? Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Malcolm Gladwell's article in this week's New Yorker is titled How David Beat Goliath When Underdogs Break the Rules. His most recent book is Outliers, The Story of Success, and he joins us today from NPR's Bureau in New York. Nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. Delighted to be back.
And the question persists. Mr. Ranadiv was not the only person to figure out that if you play the full court press every minute of every game, well, you can win with players who are not quite the same stature or skill level as that big other team.
Yes. There's been, for as long as people have played basketball, a number of teams have used the full court press, and often to great effect. But the puzzling question is why many, many more teams don't use that strategy, since it does seem to be one of the few strategies available to an underdog that allows them to compete with a Goliath. And the same is true in war. You know, I use the example of war as well in the article, that when we look at the history of warfare between very powerful countries and much weaker adversaries, when the adversaries choose to fight unconventionally, they actually win the majority of the time. But the amazing thing is how infrequently smaller countries actually choose to fight that way.
And some of the examples you give are, well, one is the American Revolution, where George Washington eschewed the tactics that were used at the start of the war when Americans relied more on insurgent or guerrilla-type tactics and went very early on to develop the Continental Line, a very conventional British-style army, and, eventually learned that after many stinging defeats that he had to pick his battles very carefully.
And he got, let's not forget, he got bailed out by the French.
Indeed.
I say this as a, you know, I'm an Englishman, so my sympathies are with the other side. So I just want to set the record straight on 1776.
General Washington did manage to eke out a victory there.
Yes, he did. I'll concede that much.
But again, because he was raised in the society where he had wanted to become an English army officer, a member of the British Army, he was unable to break the convention even with the example of American military successes in front of him.
Yeah, it raises this whole question of Davids and Goliaths, raises this really interesting question, which is we often have a set of assumptions and conventions about the way battles, in whatever context, are supposed to be fought. And the interesting question is, are those conventions rational? That is to say, do they make sense? Or are they simply rules of conventions that are being propagated by the Goliaths in order to extend and maintain their own dominance? I mean, the guy I wrote about, this guy Vivek Ranadiv, his observation that begins his whole journey with this, with his girls, these 12-year-old girls' basketball team, is that the conventional way you play basketball, when the minute you score, you retreat immediately to your own end and await the other team, let them come down the court to meet you, that way, if you play basketball that way, what you are doing is you're almost ensuring that the stronger team is always going to win. Because the stronger team's strengths are all those things that they do in the offensive end of the court: shooting, passing, dribbling. Your only real chance is to break the conventional mode and play defense the whole time.
And one of the things you point out is that playing full court press all the time requires that your team be in much better shape than the other team, and so you have to run and run and run and then run some more, which is difficult to do. You add, however, a crucial point. Insurgents work harder than Goliath, but their other advantage is that they are willing to do what is socially horrifying.
Yeah.
Explain to us what you mean there.
Well, very often, the set of conventions that we have in place are about how battles ought to be fought, are very often based on a sense of what's acceptable. You know, when if you look at the history of warfare, when countries first started engaging in guerrilla warfare and not wearing uniforms, wearing things that allowed them to kind of blend in with their surroundings, there was an objection made by kind of the dominant powers. It was considered to be a violation of the ethic of war, right? Similarly, when Vivek starts playing the full-court press with his 12-year-old girls, the opposing coaches get furious, and they scream at the ref, and they scream at Vivek. One of them challenges him to a fight in the parking lot after the game. There's a sense that they are violating the spirit of basketball by playing this kind of unorthodox, effort-driven style of play, as opposed to letting the girls shoot and pass and execute carefully orchestrated offensive plays. And that, you know, that is at every level when you examine the victories of David's over Goliath, you see something that appears shocking, even in the original story of David and Goliath. Remember, Goliath is disdainful. More than that, he's horrified by the fact that he's up against this shepherd who is carrying a staff and a slingshot into battle. Goliath says, that's not what the battle's all about. The rules of engagement here are that you don armor and carry a sword. So even from the beginning in that story, there is this sense that David was breaking the rules, was challenging conventions. And that is always going to excite some degree of disapproval from the dominant power.
There are examples where Goliaths can use unconventional tactics to great success, too. And you think about the NATO bombing campaign in Kosovo during the Clinton administration. And this was a context where clearly in terms of military power, the United States and its allies could completely dominate the Serbs if they wanted to. But nevertheless, they would be subject to guerrilla type tactics had they gone in on the ground. The bombing campaign, by contrast, hit the Serbs where they could not fight back. They were unable to shoot down the aircraft. They were helpless before this. And eventually, though many predicted that this would end in failure, no campaign had ever been won by air power alone, well, this unconventional tactic worked for Goliath.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's interesting. You can see, I mean, both sides can obviously choose to challenge convention, and obvious, and often to extraordinary effect. It is David, though, the underdog, who has the greatest to gain from that, obviously, because if they don't take some attempt to change strategy, they're almost destined to lose. Right? That was, I mean, Vivek Renadive's initial conclusion. That's what his initial conclusion was with this girls' basketball team, that he had only one chance of winning, whereas had he had a dominant team, he would have had many different strategies he could follow.
There are different ways to win. And the other thing you point out about the important part of the David story, not necessarily that he went into battle without a sword, without armor, with a slingshot and a staff, but what he did immediately as the battle began.
Yeah, he charges Goliath. Right. This is a part. I think it's an important part of that story. It's not just that he chooses a different set of weapons that level the playing field between him and a giant. It's that at the initial moment when he and Goliath sort of walk onto the stage where they're dueling, David runs directly at Goliath. He speeds up the pace of the encounter. Right. And I think that's it's a lovely metaphor for one of the things that Davids always have to do if they are going to defeat favorites. And that is that they have to, I talk about substituting effort for ability, that they have to try harder. You know, when you look at, I give the example in the piece of Lawrence of Arabia in 1917 in the Middle East, leading the Bedouin tribesmen against the Turks. And one of the things he does that makes that extraordinary upset possible is he dramatically outworks the Turks. Instead of, you know, they think that they're going to mass for a battle, you know, every couple of months, or there'll be some big climactic engagement. What Lawrence of Arabia does instead is attack the Turks on almost a daily basis, traveling 100 miles across the desert in a typical day. I mean, he uses a degree of effort that was inconceivable to the kind of military powers of the day, and it utterly stuns the Turks and takes them by surprise. And there's always, when you see David victories, what you see is what we think is an insurmountable deficit in terms of ability is offset by the decision to go to these heroic levels of effort. And effort at the end of the day turns out to be more powerful than ability. I think that is the That's the real nub of David and Goliath stories.
Famous quote from Napoleon in one of his early campaigns in Italy: "In the future, I may lose another battle, but I will never lose another hour." So the importance of getting on the road and marching. Time. Let's get some callers in on the conversation. Our guest, of course, Malcolm Gladwell, his staff writer for The New Yorker. His article, "How David Beats Goliath When Underdogs Break the Rules," appears in the May 11th issue of the magazine. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. Ralph is on the line from San Antonio in California.
San Antonio, Texas.
Thank you.
Malcolm, if you're ever there, look me up. Ralph Stanton. I'd love to buy you a cup of coffee. I like to call this creative marginalization. It's a trademark that I've got, but basically it's similar to your tipping point and outliers that you talk about, how people that are marginalized in a geography, they become more creative in their actions. And I think that geography is the biggest play with David, and a good example of it is Barack Obama. Barack Obama was the underdog with his campaigns and everything else 3 years ago. 2006, nobody thought Barack Obama had a chance. Now, I happened to be in Iraq in 2007, and everybody kept saying that Hillary Clinton was going to win, or that Mitt Romney or John McCain, and Barack Obama had decentralized all of his campaign to local geographies through the internet, and completely unconventional for the presidential campaigns, and ended up winning that way. So I just wanted to thoughts about it.
More in the primary, I would think your analogy holds, Ralph, than in the general. But go ahead. What do you think?
Yeah, this is, I mean, I think you're absolutely right on. I mean, if you look at, so the examples I was interested in, so I start with this example of Vivek Ranadive and this 12-year-old basketball team. Why does he play that way? Because he's Indian, because he doesn't grow up with the game and has no allegiance whatsoever to the kind of conventional ways of playing basketball. He looks at basketball through the eyes of someone who grew up with soccer, right? Which is a profoundly different sort of, has a profoundly different ethos. Lawrence of Arabia. Why does Lawrence of Arabia kind of pioneer all of these techniques of insurgency? Because he is not a conventional British military officer. He was an archaeologist. Pardon me?
Oprah Winfrey also.
Oh, yes. I mean, we can go on and on and find that time and time again, you're absolutely right. It is outsiders who bring to a particular stage or domain a completely different set of assumptions, who are able to see these kinds of strategically useful examples. It says, you know, I would joke when I was hanging around with Vivek Ranadive, I was always joking, you know, maybe lots of American basketball teams should have Indian coaches. You know, maybe there's more wisdom to be mined here.
Ralph, thanks very much.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And keep writing. I enjoy your book.
Thank you.
We're again talking with Malcolm Gladwell of The New Yorker. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This from Michael in Tucson, Arizona. Speaking of underdogs who break the rules in sports, one of the greatest examples is the ski jumper Jan Bokloff. I hope I'm not mispronouncing that too badly. He essentially could not jump in the regular style, instead created his own style, which was at first criticized, then adopted, and is now the dominant style. And I think you see that about the Fosbury flop in high jumping, too.
Yeah.
Unconventional approaches by people who had no other choice because they couldn't win the regular way.
Yeah. I mean, this raises this really interesting question, Neil, which is, are there ways, if so much of this kind of disruptive innovation comes from outsiders, is there a way to try and encourage or institutionalize the influence of outsiders? I mean, should we go out of our way to try and import different ideas to traditional fields? When I was, you know, I was joking about should more teams have Indian basketball coaches. You know, we see this. There, for example, lots of soccer teams around the world have Dutch coaches, right? Even countries that have nothing to do with Holland or have the furthest cultural distance from Holland have seen fit to import a wholly different perspective, a highly kind of communal collectivist culture, import that to their soccer teams because they recognize its value. And I, you know, there's a really wonderful little insight there that I wonder whether we could make better use of in other aspects of our society.
Well, you have to decide right away whether you're going to be David or Goliath. Most of us, in most of the circumstances, are more Davids than Goliaths. Nevertheless, these lessons, as you point them out, clearly somebody at the Pentagon looks at this and say, well, we're always Goliath.
Always Goliath. Yeah. I mean, I think in education, Education is another area where we can ask this question, which is, we have a group of children who are Davids, who are coming into battle radically undermanned and underprepared and being dwarfed by Goliaths. And the question is, what set of strategies can we give them? And I was really, you know, in my last book, Outliers, I have that whole chapter on the KIPP schools that have had such a wonderful track record in educating underprivileged kids, and they are following a David strategy. The gist of their educational philosophy is, we will take these kids from poor areas, and they will outwork their middle class counterparts. That's how they will keep pace, and so they do this radical schedule, which is, they are spending 60% more time in class. They're coming in on the weekends. They're coming in for an extra 3 weeks in the summer. And that's to me, a beautiful illustration of how you take insurgents' rules, David's rules, and apply them in different areas.
It seems to be the old Hertz-Avis contest. We try harder.
That's right. Yeah.
And many applications in business as well. A fascinating article. Thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you so much, Neil.
Malcolm Gladwell, a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine. The article we're talking about is How David Beats Goliath When Underdogs Break the Rules, and it appears in the May 11th issue of The New Yorker magazine. Malcolm Gladwell's most recent book is called Outliers, The Story of Success. Coming up tomorrow, it's Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Ira Flatow will be here. A tiny skeleton with big feet is raising new questions about human evolution. Ira will talk about the mysterious hobbit skeleton, plus new research on why the flu turns deadly, all tomorrow on Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Our Best of the Week email newsletter also goes out tomorrow. You can still sign up for that at npr.org/talk. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you again on Monday. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. And break the laws that they should fear, and frighten all who see or hear. The cry goes up both far and near for underdog. 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 Speed of lightning, roar of thunder.